The headlines this hour. Eid al-Fitr marks the end of the Muslim fasting month of Ramadan, with people in Iran and other countries performing special congressional prayers to celebrate the occasion. The rights group says Israel is holding close to 600 Palestinians without charge or trial, the highest in 6 years. Plus, Russian President Putin signs a decree to impose tit-for-tat sanctions on unfriendly states and entities. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Muslims in several countries celebrate Eid al-Fitr, a major Islamic feast that marks the end of the holy fasting month of Ramadan. Iranians have marked the auspicious occasion with worshippers attending Eid al-Fitr prayers nationwide. Iraq, India, and Pakistan have also commemorated the event. Other Muslim nations observe the Eid on Sunday and Monday. The timing of the occasion can differ in various countries. That depends on the sighting of the new moon, which marks the beginning of the month of Shawwal on the lunar calendar. Eid al-Fitr is an official holiday in all Muslim countries.
The fasting month of Ramadan is over, and Muslims have ushered in the second most important festivity in Islam, Eid al-Fitr, or the Festival of Breakfast. Muslims start their Eid al-Fitr by taking part in congregational prayers themed with bidding farewell to Ramadan and welcoming the Eid. After they complete the Eid al-Fitr prayer, Muslims then visit their relatives and loved ones during the festivity. It's the first time in 2 years that Muslims have marked Eid al-Fitr without COVID curbs, so they can celebrate Eid al-Fitr together.
Over the past 2 years, we were not able to visit the elderly and other relatives. Thanks God, the coronavirus has subsided, and we can celebrate Eid al-Fitr with the people we love.
Every year on Eid al-Fitr, Muslims set aside a portion of their annual income, dhabt fitriya, to donate it to the poor. They say this is to spread the happy mood of Eid al-Fitr among the needy.
Zakat al-Fitr is a very small portion of our income, but it makes a significant difference when all affording Muslims join in. This way, the rich and the poor share the festive mood of Eid al-Fitr.
Eid al-Fitr falls on the first day of the lunar month of Shawwal. According to the Islamic lunar calendar, months begin and end depending on the movement of the moon in its orbit around the Earth. And the start of each month depends on the sighting of the new moon the day before. Iran sighted the Eid al-Fitr crescent on the eve of Tuesday, while many other Muslim nations announced the festivity on Sunday and Monday.
Eid al-Fitr is a culmination of 1 month of abstinence from eating and drinking. And that's why Muslims consider it a divine reward for their success in obeying God's order. This year, the festive mood is multiplied as Muslims can celebrate it together without the worries of the pandemic. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The number of Palestinians held in Israeli prisons under so-called administrative detention policy has hit a 6-year high. The regime uses this policy to put Palestinians behind bars without charge or trial for an indefinite period. We discussed the matter with our guests in the News Review program. Let's see what they had to say. An Israeli rights group says the regime is holding around 600 Palestinians in administrative detention, keeping them behind bars without charge or trial. Hamokid Group says the number is the highest since the year 2016. Says administrative detainees are arrested on what it calls secret evidence. The group says those detainees are unaware of the accusations against them and are denied the right to defend themselves in court. The so-called administrative detention allows the Israeli regime to indefinitely keep Palestinians behind bars. The practice has drawn widespread international criticism, including from the UN, calling for an end to it over violating the rights of prisoners. In the past years, Palestinian administrative detainees have on various occasions held hunger strikes to protest their jail conditions. Mona Kandil is a correspondent joining us from occupied Ramallah to tell us more about this, and Jafar Ramini, who's a Palestinian writer and political analyst, joins us from Perth for an analysis on this. Well, Mona, tell us about the not-so-good news of the number of prisoners that have been detained, and if you have any indications as to how this has happened in terms of the increase.
Well, we have to say something about the administrative detainees. At the time, Israeli authorities hold Palestinians under administrative detention and as administrative detainees. They continue to hold suspects, according to them, while continuing to gather evidence and against them. So practically, they have nothing against them. these are only suspicions, or sometimes they are known for being, let's say, part or members of Palestinian, let's say, Palestinian resistance groups, but the Israeli authorities don't have clear evidence against them, so they are held in the Israeli jails under the so-called administrative detention. Suspects or those Palestinian prisoners are held for 6 months. These 6 months could be renewed for several times. At the end of the day, those Palestinian administrative detainees find themselves behind bars for sometimes 10 years. Can you imagine someone in jail for 10 years without knowing what are the charges against them? They and their lawyers don't know what are the charges against them. As you have mentioned, we are speaking about almost 600 Palestinian under administrative detention. It's the highest number since 2016. Since the beginning of this year, Palestinian administrative detainees, as well as their lawyers, are not attending the hearings or the courts. They don't have the right to defend themselves, but they go to the court and in order that their detention is renewed every time they go, and the Israeli, judge renew their detention without telling them what are the charges against them.
We got 1 minute, Jafar Ramini. Taking a look at your statement where you said that the tide is turning, do you think that when you see these types of stats and figures, that you're going to get Palestinians that are going to come out, more Palestinians that are going to come out after what we saw in the month of Ramadan, that are going to protest against the Israeli occupation?
Well, look, we will continue resisting. But when I say that the tide is changing, I meant it. I mean, I don't know whether you are aware, none other than Prince Turki Al-Faisal yesterday. I mean, it's an Saudi prince who is to be taken seriously, has come out in an interview on the Arab TV and said that Israel should be held accountable like you're holding Russia accountable, and Israel should be sanctioned. I mean, for me, Saudi Arabia, for God's sake, to say something like that, they have always been with America and Israel, and now what they mean or not, I don't know. Only right. Prince Turki knows. But this is a huge shift that the Saudi government is allowing this to come out. A mainstream prince who was the head of the security services in Saudi Arabia for many years and an ambassador to America and to Britain. I met him a few times in London. He's sure. an intelligent man, he's an intellectual, and he came out and said it clearly. You are hypocrites. Why do you sanction Russia over Ukraine and not Israel over the Palestinians? Despite us, many okay. Arab countries has normalized. Nothing has changed.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you, Jafar Ramini, Palestinian writer and political analyst. Mona Kandil, thank you so much. Of course, one of them from Ramallah. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Day 69 of the war in Ukraine, Russian forces shell towns and cities across the eastern front line, including the second largest city, Kharkiv. The Russians are pushing to take control of Kharkiv. In the Luhansk region, they're closing in on the city of Pomsana from three directions. And in Donetsk region, Russian shelling has killed three civilians in the city of Vuhledar. That's according to the Ukrainian president's office. In the south, fighting rages on for control of the port city of Odessa. In another southern port city, Mariupol, which is almost under full Russian control, the evacuation of civilians is due to resume. Dozens have already left. The city's mayor says 100,000 civilians are still trapped there. 200 of them are holed up in a Ukrainian-held steelworks, which is under heavy shelling. The Russian President Vladimir Putin issues a new decree imposing retaliatory economic sanctions against, quote, unfriendly countries and entities. The Kremlin says the move is in response to anti-Russia measures taken by some countries and international organizations. Russia will prohibit the export of products and raw materials to people and entities under sanctions. The order also bans transactions with individuals and companies from certain countries and asks Russian counterparts not to fulfill their obligations towards them. The Russian government has 10 days to compile a list of foreign individuals and companies to be blacklisted. The U.S., the EU, and some of their allies have imposed a wave of sanctions on Moscow since it launched a war on Ukraine in late February. Fred Weir is a journalist and political commentator who joins us from Moscow. Fred Weir, it's interesting how Russia is not naming those entities or states. It's going to do so, I'm deducting, in 10 days based on what reports have indicated. But to make sure that we're clear on this matter, this is about Russian gas and oil to countries that are not going to go with the scheme that Russia has asked, and that is to pay in rubles, correct?
No, it's probably more far-reaching than that. Russia feels itself under attack from every possible direction. It's getting it in the neck. And, of course, it doesn't have the economic power to fire back equally. So I think the Russian idea will be to find some selected targets where it can make its point. The trick in is to hurt the target and not have it blow back on yourself. And one of the things we're learning from all these Western sanctions right now is that there's a tremendous amount of self-inflicted collateral damage in the West, even though they're also hurting Russia. An example of a clever way to do it was the Russians in 2015. They announced a whole series of counter sanctions against the European Union, which was sanctioning them in finance and industry and so on. They banned European food products from Russia, from being imported into Russia. And that hurt European countries who had been major exporters, and it stimulated Russian agriculture so that by this time, like it's only 7-8 years later, Russian agriculture is practically self-sufficient because it grew up under this protectionist wall that appeared in the guise of counter-sanctions. So presumably the Russians will be looking at some targeted, specific ways to hit back, although they can't do it on anything resembling the same scale that the West is doing it to them.
But what's very interesting about this, and correct me if I'm wrong, based on the statements that are coming out from the EU, in this case, in point that I want to ask you, they're very contradictory, because you have on the one hand the EU coming out and saying, we're going to sanction any country that buys Russian gas and oil in the EU countries if they do that deposit in euros or dollars and for it to get exchanged. But at the same time, you have the EU Energy Commissioner that said, you know, we're going to have to wait and see how this is going to pan out until the end of the year. And at the same time, you have countries that are continuing to buy Russian oil and gas. I mean, really, there's no recommendation of a replacement, but just threats of sanctions.
Yes, this is a really good example of how sanctions can be a self-inflicted wound, where Europe is pretty much dependent on Russian gas. They can wean themselves from oil because oil is a more fungible product. You can buy oil from other parts of the market, but gas is usually delivered in dedicated pipelines and long-term contracts, and Europe doesn't have that many alternative sources. They'll develop them, and it will in time happen if, you know, they politically set their mind to weaning themselves from Russian gas. They eventually will, but not anytime soon. And so this is the dance that they're doing, because the Russians have demanded payment in rubles. And that's a very clever move, because it forces the buyers in so-called unfriendly countries to do the job of the Russian central bank, which is to prop up the ruble by buying rubles. Increasing the demand for rubles raises the value of the ruble, and that is happening. The ruble has rebounded to a stronger position than it was before the war. So this is the problem for European countries, how to hurt Russia without doing more damage to themselves. And some countries, like Poland, have refused to do that ruble thing, to buy Russian gas in rubles, and they have already been cut off. Poland has already cut off Russian gas. However, of course, they're buying gas from neighboring countries, primarily Germany, and it's Russian gas, of course, but they're not having to pay in rubles, which is just too far a step for the Poles to accept. Politically, it's not economics. Other countries like Hungary have agreed to pay in rubles. Austria and Hungary are paying in rubles, and The Hungarian premier said the other day that about 10 European Union countries are already paying for their gas in rubles. And for the foreseeable future, they probably will. They'll just find ways not to concede it or to hide it. But cutting off Russian gas would just be too painful for Europe, not for Russia, because they can find alternative markets even for their gas.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Fred Weir, journalist and political commentator from Moscow. Many thanks. Moving on, the Iranian foreign minister says negotiations to restore the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA have not stopped and are continuing in a different format. In an interview, Hossein Amir Abdollahian said Iran and the U.S. are exchanging written messages to the EU representative to the Vienna talks. He said the process is aimed at the removal of unilateral U.S. sanctions. The talks began in April of last year, but with only a few issues remaining to be settled. The negotiators left the Austrian capital several weeks ago and have since not returned. Amir Abdollahian added that Iran seeks a robust and durable deal and has asked Americans to be realistic. The top diplomat said the U.S. is fully aware of Iran's red lines and has been notified that the removal of all sanctions and the provision of economic guarantees are among Tehran's key demands. The family of an Iranian national on trial in Sweden for alleged rights abuses say Hamid Nouri, a retired employee of the Iranian judiciary, was humiliated, beaten, and denied access to medical services. Swedish prosecutors have requested life imprisonment for Nouri over alleged human rights violations against members of the anti-Iran terror group Mojahedin-e Khalq organization back in the 1980s. Videos on social media show MKO members harassing Nouri's family as they enter a court building. The footage shows that Swedish police failed to protect the family. Meanwhile, Nouri's wife laments that Swedish officials did not allow them to even meet him for nearly 2 years after his arrest. On Sunday, Iran's foreign ministry summoned the Swedish ambassador to protest the detention and trial of Nouri. The ministry said it considers Nouri's detention illegal and based on propaganda by the anti-Iran terror group MKO. The ministry rejected allegations against Nouri as baseless and described his trial as political show. The MKO is responsible for killing some 12,000 Iranian people and officials in the 1980s, including the country's then-president and prime minister. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Eid al-Fitr, the Eid of struggling to form a unified Muslim nation. According to the works and statements of great religious personalities, one of the characteristics of Eid al-Fitr is that it is the Eid of the United Islamic Ummah. He is one who turned this day into an Eid for Muslims. It is the Eid of all Muslims. This means the outlook of the holy religion of Islam is towards building an Islamic Ummah. The same outlook exists in the teachings of the great Prophet of Islam. When we look at many Islamic teachings, we witness an effort for creating a united Ummah. Today, the Islamic Ummah is disintegrated. This disintegration does not mean differences between Islamic denominations. These differences are natural and they are not contrary to forming a united Ummah. Different beliefs and opinions can exist on major and minor issues alongside a united Ummah. What has separated Muslims from one another today is policies, political motivations, and motivations for seizing power. Muslim countries can pass through these motivations. This is the responsibility of political and influential personalities and those who have governmental positions in Islamic countries. If this happens, then a kind of power will emerge that is better than and superior to, in the real sense of the word, all transgressing and arrogant powers in the world. If this happens, no one will be able to bully an Islamic country, and no power will be able to blackmail Islamic countries and Muslim governments. If we stay together, if we pay attention to and focus on our common points, if hunger for power, selfishness, dependence, and corruption do not separate us from one another, then a power will be formed that can defend and support the rights and interests of 1.5 billion Muslims. But unfortunately, such a thing does not exist today.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The important point is that we should appreciate the value of such opportunities. Allah the Exalted made auspicious Eid al-Fitr a source of honor and dignity for the Islamic Ummah and for the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. You made it an Eid for the Muslims and for Muhammad, God's greetings be upon him and his household, and a source of honor and dignity and bounty. This is an instrument for increasing the dignity and honor and of the Islamic Ummah and the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. This depends on how we Muslims make use of such opportunities and occasions. The Muslim nations can use the month of Ramadan and Eid al-Fitr as an instrument to achieve glory and dignity. They can use them as a ladder to climb towards spiritual and material improvement and towards dignity in this world and in the next. We should be vigilant. We should use these opportunities.
That you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has once again stated that Pyongyang could preemptively use its nuclear weapons if threatened. In a meeting with the top military brass, Kim expressed a firm will to continue developing his nuclear-armed military so that it could preemptively and thoroughly contain and frustrate all dangerous attempts and threatening moves, including ever-escalating nuclear threats from hostile forces if necessary. His comments come as he praised his top military officials over the staging of a massive military parade in the capital Pyongyang last Monday. The parade marked the 90th anniversary of the founding of the Korean People's Revolutionary Army. It also featured the country's latest intercontinental ballistic missiles. On that occasion, too, Kim vowed to accelerate the development of North Korea's nuclear arsenal.
The basic mission of our nuclear force is to deter war, but our nuclear weapons cannot be bound to only one mission. If any force attempts to usurp the fundamental interests of our country, our nuclear force will have no choice but to carry out its second mission unexpectedly.
The country has progressed its nuclear and missile program despite international pressure over the past years. North Korea has conducted 13 rounds of weapons launches in 2022 alone, including its first full-range test of an intercontinental ballistic missile since 2017. In addition, satellite imagery has shown signs of activity at a nuclear testing site. Pyongyang has been reeling under crippling international sanctions over its nuclear weapons and ballistic missile development activities, which it maintains are designed to deter potential aggression by the U.S. and its allies, including South Korea, who frequently hold joint military drills and weapon tests on the Korean Peninsula. Meanwhile, South Korea says Pyongyang's military tests escalate tensions and worsen ties between the two neighbors, but Pyongyang says its tests are in response to mounting tensions on the Korean Peninsula triggered by joint military exercises between Seoul and Washington. The United States also stations about 28,500 troops in the south. The latest developments come as South Korea prepares for an incoming president, Yoon Suk-yeol, who takes a more hawkish approach to Pyongyang and has not ruled out a preemptive strike if necessary, vowing to strengthen the South's defense in conjunction with the alliance with the United States. Nuclear negotiations between Washington and Pyongyang have been stalled since 2019 because of disagreements over a potential easing of U.S.-led sanctions in exchange for North Korean disarmament steps. Former U.S. President Donald Trump met with the North's leader three times, but he refused to meet Pyongyang's demand for the removal of some sanctions in return for major North Korean measures toward demilitarization. Meanwhile, the current administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has imposed sanctions on dozens of North Korean people and entities. Surely, that's not a sign of goodwill to resolve differences. There is also the issue of South Korea. The new president is pro-U.S., adding to the friction between the two Koreas. Meanwhile, Kim has stuck to his goal of simultaneously developing nuclear weapons and the country's dismal economy in the face of sanctions, and has shown no willingness to fully surrender a nuclear arsenal he sees as his biggest guarantee of survival.
The Democratic People's Republic of Korea, also known as North Korea, has always, from day one of its founding as a sovereign nation and republic, a people's republic, has always developed its military capabilities in defense against U.S. imperialism, against European imperialism.
Pyongyang has time and again stressed that the primary role of possessing nukes was to discourage threats against the country. After all, it makes sense, particularly when we look at the example of Ukraine. Even the Ukrainian ambassador to Tehran confessed that his country should have developed its military capabilities instead of relying on guarantees from foreign forces such as NATO.
A recent report by the Council on American-Islamic Relations shows anti-Muslim hate crimes have been on the rise in the United States over the past year. In a news conference following the publication of the report, head of the council, Nihad Awad, described Islamophobia in the United States as deep and systematic.
Islamophobia has become mainstream in America. It made its way into the government's institutions and public sphere through laws, policies, political rhetoric, and other manifestations.
Yeah, Islamophobia has been a huge phenomenon in the U.S. since 2001, when the September 11th false flag operation was deliberately used by enemies of Islam to trigger this tidal wave of hatred of Muslims and Islam that led to a series of wars that killed millions of people.
The report shows that the council received over 6,700 complaints nationwide last year, the highest the organization has recorded in 27 years, which represented a 9% increase since the year before. They involved a range of issues, including immigration, travel discrimination, law enforcement, government overreach, hate and bias, custody rights, school incidents, and free speech. Over 2,800 of the incidents were reportedly travel-related. The report cites last year's tensions in Afghanistan and the ensuing immigration crisis as the reason for such a large figure. The report also cites a 28% increase in complaints of hate and bias incidents, including the forcible removal of hijabs, harassment, vandalism, physical assault, and so on. The Council on the American Islamic Relations describes what it calls the Islamophobia Network as a decentralized group of actors, organizations, and individuals that share extreme anti-Muslim ideologies who lobby to influence government policy and public opinion about Islam. They include politicians, think tanks, scholars, religious groups, and activists that paint a distorted face of Islam and Muslims for political and financial gain. Listed among the top financiers of the Islamophobia Network, according to the council, are right-wing evangelical groups and pro-Israel organizations, most of whom are members of the Republican Party.
Islamophobia has not only been profitable for Zionists and the military-industrial complex and politicians, but also for these con artists who've created an Islamophobia industry that sells all kinds of books and drums up contributions, often at churches, and gets funded by these billionaire, mostly Zionists.
Back in December, the U.S. House voted for legislation to counter Islamophobia globally. The lawmakers voted along party lines, with the Democrats edging only 7 votes over the 212 that the Republicans had cast. It followed U.S. Representative Lauren Boebert's Islamophobic comments against Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, one of the handful Muslim lawmakers in the U.S., earlier that month.
The Islamophobia industry comes up with all sorts of nonsense and sort of distorted, cherry-picked items from the religious tradition mixed in with all sorts of lies and kinds of grotesque accusations. And then it spams this out in mass, and so it's really polluting the entire infosphere.
The United Nations has called for the adoption of a global strategy that includes defeating all forms of violent ideologies. The question is how to execute such a strategy to make it appealing to all nations and people.
The conflict in Ukraine has raised the prospects of an all-out confrontation between nuclear-armed states. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has warned about a real danger of World War III breaking out. In his comments to Russian media outlets, Lavrov added that given the current tensions between Russia and the West, the danger of a World War III was, quote, real. Lavrov also criticized Ukraine's approach to the talks and said if negotiations do not move in a reciprocal way, the negotiation process will be hampered. Lavrov also accused NATO of engaging in a war with Russia through a proxy.
I think that the U.S. and their allies have been pushing the world towards a sort of World War III or even a new Cold War mentality for months and even years now with the kind of propaganda and various official lines that the United States and their closest allies like Great Britain, France, and Germany have been pushing against Russia.
Meanwhile, Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba has criticized his Russian counterpart for warning of a real danger of World War III, saying Lavrov's comments indicated that, quote, Moscow senses defeat. Lavrov's warning came after the U.S. pledged more aid to Ukraine. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken paid a top-secret visit to Kyiv on Sunday and promised to supply more arms to Ukraine.
And I think that the NATO encroachment and the furthering of NATO interests throughout Europe as they get closer and closer to Russia's borders justifies some reaction from Russia. And the United States is going to continue pushing in their interest, which is only going to get us closer to World War III.
Meanwhile, Russian President Vladimir Putin hosted UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres in the Kremlin on Tuesday for talks revolving around the Ukrainian crisis. Putin said Moscow's move to recognize the breakaway republics of Donetsk and Luhansk was based on the Kosovo precedent set up by a UN-backed court. Following the meeting, the UN said Russian President agreed in principle to UN involvement in evacuations of civilians from Azovstal steel plant. Meanwhile, dozens of U.S. allies met in Germany to bolster Ukraine's military. Traditionally neutral countries of Sweden and Finland are also taking part in the meeting. The conference secured pledges from allies to sustain aid to Ukraine's military throughout this next phase of the war and beyond. The meeting saw a major pledge from Germany, which said it would deliver tanks to Ukraine in a radical switch in policy on the supply of military equipment to the country. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin added, the conference would transform into a monthly contact group on Ukraine's self-defense. According to a Pentagon official, at least 18 of the 19 towed artillery pieces Washington promised in the past 2 weeks have already been delivered to Ukrainian forces, and more are being rushed this week. In addition, Washington is supplying nearly 200,000 rounds of howitzer ammunition and is arranging for ammunition supplies for the Russian-made artillery that Ukrainian forces currently operate. France is sending its ultra-advanced Caesar mobile howitzer, and the Czech Republic is delivering its older self-propelled howitzers. Canada, too, is sending howitzers and advanced guided Excalibur shells that can travel more than 40 kilometers and deliver munitions precisely on target. The UK, on the other side, said it will send Stormer armored vehicles carrying anti-missile launchers to Kyiv. British Defense Secretary Ben Wallace said the country is also looking to provide Ukraine with long-range artillery and ammunition, as well as anti-ship missiles.
So, I believe there is a limit to how far these countries will allow the United States to use them. And I think that when it comes to threats of nuclear war or the risk of a, you know, all-out World War III with Russia, I do think that we're going to see states in Europe start to stand up to that U.S. imperialism and try and go against them, maybe even allying with Russia themselves.
The European Commission insists that arming Ukraine is not about prolonging the conflict. However, a growing number of civil society organizations and lawmakers in the European countries believe the West should be prioritizing peace talks over arms delivery. Moscow has warned Western countries of the unpredictable consequences for arming Ukraine. Russia says it views Western military supplies to Ukraine as legitimate targets.
Israel is stepping up its atrocities against Palestinians. Israeli forces have shot and killed a young Palestinian man in Jenin. The man was identified as 21-year-old Ahmed Mohammed Lutfi Massad. He was a resident of the town of Burkin. He was killed during a raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the early hours of Wednesday. Officials say Massad had been shot in the head. Three other Palestinians with moderate wounds were transferred to the medical facility as well. The Israeli troops broke into dozens of homes and violently searched them, causing excessive property damage before detaining at least three Palestinians. Massad's death follows that of another Palestinian killed on Tuesday when Israeli forces stormed a refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. 20-year-old Ahmed Ibrahim Owaidat was killed during the shooting in Akabat Jaber camp near Ariha. Nearly 50 Palestinians have been killed by Israelis since the start of 2022. Jenin has become the target of increasing Israeli military raids, arrests, and targeted assassinations in an attempt to crack down on growing Palestinian armed resistance there. The regime in Tel Aviv has escalated its crackdown on Palestinians since the beginning of the Muslim holy fasting month of Ramadan. It has also arrested dozens of Palestinians in the occupied East Al-Quds and desecrated Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Well, I think clearly Israel is trying to provoke the Palestinians. You know, this is just part of their long-term campaign of wanting to take more and more land from the Palestinians, to take over holy sites in Jerusalem that they want for themselves. And again, they're trying to provoke a response that would justify a greater military incursion, I think, into places like the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Damascus Gate.
The regime has further imposed new restrictions on the Palestinian people's entry into the mosque and ordered the demolition of Palestinian homes and agricultural facilities. There are fears of a possible large-scale Israeli invasion of Jenin Camp. The armed wings of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Fatah movements are active there. Last week, settler incursions under police protection led to daily confrontations with Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Many Palestinians were injured and arrested. The Palestinian resistance movement of Hamas has also harshly warned Israel against further atrocities against Palestinian people. Hamas says Israeli threats would not discourage the Palestinian people from keeping up their legitimate struggle against the occupying regime.
Well, again, I think Israel's plan is to take over all of Palestine, to push the Palestinians farther and farther out of, in particular, the West Bank, but also Gaza. I mean, it's really a genocidal plan, right? I mean, the plan is either to starve out the Palestinians, force them to leave as refugees, as many have, so that Israel can take over the entire, piece of land there.
The heightened tensions come as people around the world are gearing up for Quds Day rallies around the world. The annual event is held on the last Friday of Ramadan. It was initiated by the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Khomeini, in 1979 to express solidarity with Palestinians and staunch opposition to Zionism. Palestinians have called on Muslim nations to play a more assertive role in securing the cessation of the Israeli regime's occupation.
اللهم أهل الكبرياء والعظمة وأهل الجود والجبروت وأهل العفو والرحمة وأهل التقوى والمغفرة أسألك بحق هذا اليوم الذي جعلته للمسلمين عيدا ولمحمد صلى الله عليه وآله زخرا وشرفا وكرامة
We here at IRIB English Radio congratulate the Islamic Ummah and all world Muslims on the blessed occasion of the Eid al-Fitr. A joyous Eid al-Fitr to you all.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان
احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه الصلاة والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام ما قال الناس لشيء طوبى له إلا وقد خبأ له الدهر يوم سوء.
Imam Ali stated, "For everything to which people say, 'How good,' there is an evil hidden in this world."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Imam Ali alayhi salam's persona is truly universal. It is a persona which is applicable to any race or even, we say, any religion. For the persona of Imam Ali is a sea of wisdom, knowledge, and truth. And so this sea, this ocean of wisdom and knowledge and truth is applicable to everyone. We find that the personas of the Ahlul Bayt and the personas of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam, and of course talking about the persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, they are timeless personas. They are personas who have lasted throughout time and will continue to last throughout time because, dear friends, they are sourced to the source of knowledge and wisdom and the creator of time, the Almighty Allah. Now, we find that Imam Ali alayhi salam himself was a very just leader. He was a very fair-minded leader. He was a leader, an imam, and a caliph, a khalifa, a leader of the Muslims who, of course, did not show discrimination, he did not show injustice, and he did not show prejudice. He never favored one person over another without any reason. Now we find that along these lines, Imam Ali alayhi salam said that there are three groups of people whose prayers are never rejected. One of those groups of people is a fair-minded leader who treats his subjects with justice. Now we might think, well, I'm not a leader, I'm not the president or the prime minister or the king or queen of a country, I'm not the caliph, I'm not the leader of the Muslims, I'm not, an imam in this sense of being immaculate. But are we not a leader in one form or the other? If we're a mother or a father, we are a leader. If we are a older brother or sister, an older cousin, then we are a leader. In the workplace, if there are people who work under us, then we are a leader. If we run the local masjid, the local mosque, or the local Islamic center, then we are a leader. Among our friends, we are a leader. And so we take this statement and we add it to this idea that we are all leaders in one way, shape, form, or the other. And so if we treat those under us with justice, with equity, with fairness, with kindness, with mercy, then our prayers will never be rejected, of course, if those prayers are in our best interests. A beautiful, profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم إني أسألك الأمان يوم لا ينفع مال ولا بنون إلا من أتى الله بقلب سليم.
O Allah, I ask you for the protection of the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil.
وأسألك الأمان يوم يعض الظالم على يدي يقول يا ليتني اتخذت مع الرسول سبيلا.
And I ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, "Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger."
Hey, don't, 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 Ali.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
كل صبح وكل اشراق ايام تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاق قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبيب لها ولا راغي
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
His name brings about a sense of strength in the heart. His remembrance is a source of inspiration for the souls. His legacy is widespread throughout the centuries and around the world. And this recognition is a recognition that continues, and we see it indeed all around in different places all around the world, strengthening as time progresses. And it is not only Muslims who have indeed discovered the beauty of Ali ibn Abi Talib. Even non-Muslims now have begun to explain their admiration of how this individual has left this impression upon themselves. There is a Christian by the name of Paul Salama. He is a Christian Lebanese historian and poet. He comes and he has a long poem in praise of Amir al-Mu'mineen. He says amongst his poem in honor of Ali, he says, لا تقل شيعة هوات علي إن في كل منصف شيعية. He says, don't say it is only the Shia who love Ali ibn Abi Talib. Because there are people who have intellect and have understood who this man is. جلجل الحق في المسيحي حتى عد من فرط حبه علويا. He says, the love of Ali has become so strong in the heart of the Christian to the extent that now he is referred to as a man who is the lover of Ali. إن لم يكن علي نبياً فَلَقَدْ كَانَ خُلْقُهُ نَبَوِيًّا. If Ali was not a prophet, I stand to say that his ethics and his morals was that of prophets. Then he concludes and he says, فَيَا سَمَاءُ شْهَدِي وَيَا أَرْضُ قَرِّي وَخْشَعِي إِنَّنِي ذَكَرْتُ عَلِيًّا. He says, O heavens, bear witness. O earth, tremble. I have mentioned the name of Ali ibn Abi. That is a recognition from individuals who have discovered the beauty of the commander of the faithful.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine.